Hey everyone, it is Max Middleweek, the founder of Zero Impact. You probably know me best from that company where we recycle waste coffee grounds into clean energy. But I have a bit of a passion project on the side that me and my team have pulled together, which talks to really passionate, knowledgeable people in the space that are getting us to a zero impact future. And we deem zero impact as having no impact on the environment, no impact on the ecosystem, no impact to climate change. And of course, we'll be revealing updates about Zero Impact 2, so stay tuned. But I'm really excited to have you listening with us, and I hope you enjoy our first episode. What's so bad about climate change?
Well, it'll destroy our way of life as we know it.
I'm sitting down to chat with Adam Bandt, who is the deputy leader of the Green Party here in Australia. And it's a really passionate, insightful and revealing conversation that we have about the dangers of climate change and what choices we face going forward.
I think people understand climate change is real, and apart from a few outliers, sadly, some of whom run our country, but most people accept that the science is right and that climate change is happening. And I think people are starting to understand that it's happening now. It's not just something that will happen in the future, but it's happening now. We're seeing it we just had our hottest summer ever. People have seen Tasmania, parts of it on fire, New South Wales burning, while parts of Queensland are flooding, and seeing fish washing up dead in our rivers. I think the penny is dropping for many, many people that this is something that is hurting us now. But perhaps what people don't quite realise is that if we don't get it under control within about a decade or so, according to the world scientists, what we're potentially looking at, potentially as early as 2030, or certainly definitely by the middle of the century, according to the predictions, you could be looking at going to every Christmas holidays every second year and being presuming that there'll be a bushfire in Victoria, or that there'll be another heat wave that will take people's lives. And even at the extreme end, the projections are that at the moment, even though we've signed up to limit global warming to 2 degrees, that we're heading closer to 4 degrees rather than 2 degrees.
Wow.
And some people, scientists have made the point that on our current projections of 4 degrees, which we could hit by the end of the century, the carrying capacity of the planet is only 1 billion people at that point, because agriculture is so smashed, and so many parts of the planet become uninhabitable. Our water resources are affected. So you're talking about getting down from where we are now down to 1 billion people. Now, that is a massive, massive shock and catastrophe by anyone's reading.
Yeah, it sounds a pretty scary future, especially when we think of our children and the next generation after them. But what drives your passion and your interest in fighting this issue?
I think that government is one of the few places that can turn the ship around in time. That I've worked before coming into this job as a MP. I worked as a barrister and a lawyer and a solicitor for about 12 years, and my commitment to social justice was representing a lot of low-paid workers, and especially people, we talk about sweatshop labour. We've got sweatshops here in Melbourne. They just happen in individual women's flats and houses in Richmond and Springvale and places like that. My job was taking big major clothing corporations that you all would have heard of and seen their ads. My job was to take them to court and say, look, you're not upholding the minimum standards for these people. And I was very happy with that as my commitment for social justice for a while, until I heard about climate change. And I at the time thought, oh, well, it's such a significant thing, I'm sure that the government's got it under control if it's significant. And it was then, sort of as it started to dawn on me, the seriousness of it, and also the fact that we were completely ignoring it, that's when I quit my job and started running in elections. So for me, I guess the twin things that drive me is, one is wanting to make sure that we've got a safe climate and clean air and clean water for everyone. And the second is to make sure that Australia remains an equal place and that we don't have those big gaps between big corporations on one hand and people earning $3 or $4 an hour sewing in their own sheds on the other. And they're the things that really drive me.
Yeah, amazing. I think there seems to be a big disconnect, as you're saying, between what people are, you know, share your view as well, but there seems to be a big disconnect across Australian politics, across both, you know, the government at the moment, but both sides of the House. Like, why do you think there's such division, and why is it so dysfunctional in terms of Australia's, you know, addressing climate change, especially when Australia's so far behind many other Western countries?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think the answer is, in many ways, it's unique to Australia's context, and although probably we've got a lot of similarities with US, and that is that there's some very big corporations that are making a lot of money out of a business model that's premised on wrecking the planet and causing climate change, i.e. they're digging up coal or oil or gas and they're selling it, and they're either burning it themselves or they're selling it to someone else to burn, and it's making enormous amounts of money. And in a political system that we've got where corporations can effectively make unlimited donations to political parties and can wield huge political clout. They basically go to the others and they say, look, we'll donate to your campaigns, but if you cross us, then we'll donate to your opponent and we'll go and run a campaign to turf you out of your seat. And I saw that up close in another context when in the minority parliament in 2010 when we were in a hung parliament and we were trying to get action on the pokies. And I still remember someone from senior from the Labor Party coming and sitting next to me and saying, oh, well, look, you know, you can talk about taking action on the pokies as much as you like, but the clubs industry have been in my office and they've said there's half a dozen people in marginal seats that they'll run a campaign against if we do anything, so I'm sorry, but we're not going to do anything. Like, it's really as blatant as that in Canberra. And I think that goes a long way to explaining why the coal industry in particular has such a stranglehold on politics.
Yeah, and definitely on the subject of coal, which I know you're very passionate about, and I share the same, you know, I think we all share the same passion as you. We need to get out of coal. It's becoming rapidly uneconomic to continue firing coal power stations, but we still have a government that even, you know, is just supporting coal power stations or brown coal in Victoria and even opening new coal power stations. Is that purely the lobbying, like the coal lobbying, in the same way as the pokies, the same?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. And also, to be honest, like the kind of, if you go back to where we started the interview with the world scientists telling us last year about how soon we might hit 1.5 degrees, they said, look, to stop it happening as soon as 2030, so within sort of your and my lifetimes, to stop it happening that quickly, the world needs to be 2/3 out of coal by 2030. Now, in a country like Australia, where we've effectively built up our power system to be a series of copper and aluminium lines out to coal mines, to make that switch is a significant thing to do. And there are communities and workers in those coal-fired power stations and in those coal mines. And we need to do a very big transition, but it needs to be done in an orderly way. So it is going to require shaking things up. And what we've seen in Australia is that for governments, it's often a bit easier to bury their head in the sand and not have the honest conversation with communities about what it would mean to make that transition, even if it's going to involve a bit of disruption now. It's better that than having a cooked planet, basically, or having your kids have to pay for it. And I've been going down to coal-fired power station communities and talking about, you know, the Greens' plan is to say we need to replace coal-fired power stations with renewables. So we've been walking into towns in the Latrobe Valley, like you were mentioning, where there's brown coal, or in Muswellbrook in New South Wales, and Collie in WA, and saying, yeah, look, the Greens' plan is to close down the coal industries in this town, but here's our plan to replace it with renewables and to bring new industries to the region and make sure everyone has good, well-paying, sustainable jobs. And I think even in those regions, people are starting to get it. But we just need, I think, a bit more of that courage and honesty from our leaders.
Hmm. And do you think these communities, are they well equipped and ready for that big change? Because it sounds like a big change in the way of doing things, not only in the setup, getting out of coal into renewables, but also culturally as well. I spoke to coal miners before Hazelwood closed, and it was a very proud heritage of serving Australia basically. And what do you say to those people that have pioneered the coal industry and now going to lose their jobs and the future's uncertain?
Yeah, look, you're right, and that we should honour their history and honour what they're doing now and honour what they've done, because they've helped get us to where we are, and they're helping keep the lights on now and this podcast going, and as renewables are still stepping in, but they've played an important role. So it's not about dishonouring those people or leaving those communities behind by any means. And in fact, one of the reasons that we want to establish a national authority with a good amount of money to look after these sectors is that in a lot of these places, with a bit of planning, you could actually get some new renewables or new battery storage or pumped hydro storage in a lot of these areas, and they could continue their role as energy pioneers and energy leaders. Because when you think about it, when I went to one coal-fired town, a town with coal mines and with power stations in it, they said, look, we had our aha moment a little while ago, which is that perhaps our biggest asset is not the coal under the ground, but all the transmission lines and infrastructure above the ground. Why can't we just get someone in from the government to tell us whether we can build some renewables so that that feeds into the into those transmission lines instead, and we just flip the switch over from coal over to the others? And I think with a bit of planning, that's probably what we could do.
Adam raises a really great point here that, yes, we've seen massive prosperity arise through mining activities in Australia, especially over the past few decades with the mining boom, especially in places like WA. Now, a lot of people have become very wealthy through that, not only people in the mining industry, but also Australians generally, who benefit from all the tax revenue and other levies that arise through mining. So I can see why there is a hostility to move away from what has been so good to us as a nation. However, it actually doesn't need to be as painful as we would think, because inadvertently, through all of the coal mining infrastructure, through burning coal, there's actually all this other infrastructure that's really useful that's left over. And that's the transmission lines and the grid and all that kind of cool stuff as well, which was, I thought, just an amazing insight that we often forget about.
And I think it is definitely important because as a country, I think I'm right in saying that we only burn about a third of the coal that we actually dig up.
And about 20%.
20%.
So 80% of our coal goes overseas and gets burned overseas.
How are we going to decouple what has been the biggest rise in prosperity, basically in Australian history, strong economy, strong growth? How are we going to transition? Are we going to see that repeated again, or are people's living standards going to decline as we get away from these mining communities?
Well, I think they'll decline if we don't tackle climate change. And we've now got the Reserve Bank of Australia telling us that, and we've got the key financial regulators telling us that, and the Climate Change Authority telling us that. So you just have to look at the, let's say your analysis is just a strict economic one, you just have to look at the cost to look at how much broccoli went up in the southern states when, as a result of disasters up north, it was there wasn't as much of it to go around. Or let's look at what it's going to mean for our tourism industry when the Great Barrier Reef is bleached. Let's look at what it means when bushfire season goes for longer and the winters are shorter and there's less rainfall. What's that going to mean for our agriculture? So on the straight economic indicators, you've now got our key economic institutions in Australia saying, look, just on its own terms, we're now going to start seeing declines that we're going to have to counteract if we don't get climate change under control. So I think that the economic debate itself is significantly shifting.
Yeah. So So in light of that, what's the deal with Adani? That's a big kind of coal mining project in Queensland that will basically, you know, has impacts on the reef and climate change. How do we stop that?
Yeah, look, it's just crazy. And at a time when you've just got the world scientists saying we need a strategy to get 2/3 out of coal by 2030, the otherwise dangerous global warming will hit as soon as 2030. You've got, on the other hand, governments bending over backwards to open up new coal mines, including the Galilee Basin, which is in Queensland, is a big area broader than the Adani coal mine, but including the Adani coal mine, that at the moment the coal is still sitting there under the ground where it should be. And there's a proposal from a multinational conglomerate to basically dig it up, from a company called Adani, to dig a lot of it up and export it. And the initial proposal, they were talking about 60 million tonnes a year of coal to dig up and burn. And to give you an idea about what's in that hole of the Galilee Basin, if you dug up all the coal in the Galilee Basin and burnt it, you're basically talking about what the entire European Union puts out in 1 year.
Wow.
So we're talking about countries worth of pollution sitting there under the ground in Australia. We need to leave it there. But you've got the Queensland Labor government bending over backwards, giving them free water and giving them all sorts of sweetheart deals so that they can go ahead. You've got the Liberal Party saying, how can we help? Let us find ways of supporting you and going and fast-tracking it. But meanwhile, every reasonable-minded Australian looks on and says, this is just crazy. And so there's a growing, growing campaign to stop it. And there's going to be a convoy up to Adani and then on to Canberra, coming through Melbourne sometime within the next few weeks, as people are heading up there to say, look, we're going to put ourselves on the line and stop this thing actually going ahead.
And will that be in April, you said? Or
that'll be in April, yeah. And in the first few weeks of April, and they'll be driving up over Easter. There's a lot of, and it's going to be led by Bob Brown, that convoy, former Greens leader and strong environmental campaigner. And it's a bit like the Franklin Dam campaign, which back in the 80s, people may remember there was a rogue state government was going to go ahead and dam the Franklin River, and there was a huge campaign, and it was just in the lead up to a federal election, and the people put the pressure on the then opposition Labor Party and said, look, you've got to say that if you win government you're going to stop it. And Bob Hawke did, and there was a change of government, and Bob Hawke then passed a law and stopped it. And this is, in a sense, our generation's Franklin campaign. We have to keep this coal in the ground. And you would have seen 50,000 students and others march through the streets of Melbourne on the school climate strike.
Yes.
Just a little while ago. One of their demands was to stop Adani. And the eyes of the world are on this, and there is a big, big push in the lead up to this election to say this has to be an issue that whoever's going to form government, they promise to stop it.
So you believe that policy and government is one of the main ways to get out of these kind of bigger, like Adani or climate change? Is that the main lever that you would suggest?
We need a people-powered movement, I think. And that's the thing that politicians listen to and the politicians respond to. And, you know, let you in on a trade secret, politicians don't like to lose votes and don't like to lose their seats. And so the Stop Adani movement is now getting really big across the country and is going into those marginal seats and saying, look, sorry, but if you throw your support behind Adani, then we're going to pressure and campaign to turf you out. So it's kind of the people's movement acting in the public interest, rising up against that big power of corporate donations that I talked about earlier. You've now got a people's movement saying, look, actually, you can take all the donations you want, but if you vote for this, we're going to vote against you.
Wow. And that's even against, as you said before, like unlimited donations, corporate donations to parties, which that just seems a big fight of people power against that. And you're confident that people power can win against those bigger corporate interests?
Yeah, I am. And I think that the tide is turning, you know. Like, I think that you look at the massive marches for the climate strike and you see people are saying, look, we're fed up with you not taking climate change seriously. It's why we put you there. It's why we have a government. And if you can't take climate change seriously, then what are you there for? And we're seeing it in things like the Greens policy that we've been pushing for ages for a federal commission against corruption, the national ICAC, is now becoming mainstream policy because everyone's saying, yeah, we want, what, why is it that other governments can have corruption probes into them so that the politicians have to be kept accountable, but we don't have one at the federal level. Mm. And I think increasingly you're seeing sort of around the world too, with look at the last US presidential election and big support for, say, Bernie Sanders and the like, you're seeing a lot of people saying the current way it's going isn't enough and we want to get it back to being about the public interest. And I think that it feels to me that increasingly when you look at all of those things, that it does feel like the tide's turning, and I do feel like people at the moment are sort of at the strongest they've ever been.
Hmm. You've recently said that you wanted to ban the sale of petrol cars by 2030. Do you think that's achievable, and how are we going to pay for that?
Yeah, it is, and it's totally achievable. And I think part of what government needs to do in the transition, like there's a lot of heavy lifting that the government needs to do itself to get us on track to 100% renewables and zero pollution, including with things like electric cars. But the other thing that we need to do is give ourselves a plan and a deadline. And if government can put in place, look, we're going to be 100% renewable electricity by 2030. We're going to stop exporting coal by 2030. Hmm. You won't be able to buy a petrol car from 2030. That gives industry and new forms of industry lots of time to create anew and redefine the way that we do business. And one of the things that I would really like to see us do, when we were talking before about what else do we do apart from coal, well, we could be exporting solar power, right? There's these great new a lot of other places are switching over to hydrogen. And so if you can use solar power and wind to basically separate water into hydrogen and oxygen and then find a way of transporting that hydrogen and sending it overseas, that could be Australia's new export industry. In Western Australia, they're actually talking about, there's a project that's now got backing from commercial banks, that they're talking about building undersea cables from the northwest of Western Australia over to Singapore and Indonesia to transport electricity that would be generated on a solar panel and wind farm in northwest of Western Australia and would go on this undersea cable off to Asia. So there's amazing opportunities there. And with cars as well, we know that we've got the technology for electric cars. You just need the take-up. And I think when you look at the sustainable economy and the shared economy and that people now want to do business a bit differently, if government can put those guidelines in place and those deadlines, I reckon we could create a new, clean, caring economy that doesn't involve wrecking the planet.
Hmm. Awesome. And I think that's a really nice way to wrap up this interview, Adam. It's been a pleasure having you on speaking with us today. Do you have anything else you would like to say before we close?
Oh, look, just I'm so pleased that there's people who are thinking about how we can create new businesses and new forms of enterprise that are based on sustainability and that are based on sharing and not just one single use resource extraction, dig it up, ship it off, throw it away. And that's, I think, increasingly where people are at. And if we in Parliament and politics can do anything to hasten that transition and make it happen more quickly and to say to those kind of enterprises, you're what business should look like, then I think that's part of our job.
So that wraps up this episode with Adam Bent. You can, of course, find a full transcript in our show notes and all of the details of our conversation. We've had the help this week from our intern, Genevieve Marcocci, music by Price and live footage, and produced by Zero Impact and myself, Max Midweek. We do hope you subscribe, and we'll see you next time.